quite a lot of questions today, which is always nice. So let's see what happens as we go along here. Good day, Adnan. Okay, that's the Australian way of saying things. That's good. For most of us in the working environment, the strict application of Buddhist teachings are often a challenge. It has been said that compassion should be paired with wisdom, for example, if we are to lead a pragmatic lay life. Would much appreciate your thoughts and advice. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so compassion should be paired with wisdom, indeed, that's certainly true. And of course, there is no real compassion without wisdom. Real compassion really is a wisdom thing in the first place, because we need to understand what is really beneficial for ourselves and for other people. Sometimes the compassion can be too kind of superficial and not really deep and not really paired with a long-term understanding of what is people's happiness and what is their suffering, and then it doesn't really work out. There's a famous simile somewhere where the Buddha says that sometimes people even have to be hurt, right, if you're going to be compassionate towards them. And the simile that he uses is a simile of a child, a small child that swallows a pebble or a small stone or something like that. And if the child is choking on this pebble, sometimes you have to put your finger into the throat of that child and pull the pebble out so it doesn't die. So, in other words, you're doing something which might even draw blood, right? It might even be painful for the child, but it's for the long-term benefit. And the same thing the Buddha says, sometimes you have to say things to people that actually they may not like, but if it is beneficial and you are coming from a place of loving kindness, you know, doing things in the right way, then sometimes even if other people don't like it, it is acceptable because it is for the long-term benefit. But of course, all of this is the sort of thing that the Buddha does, and we have to be careful not to try to be the Buddha, right? If you try to be the Buddha, then often you mess it up, because it's actually quite hard to be the Buddha, to do all of these things right. So the ideal way of doing things is to try to be compassionate. But remember, when we talk about compassion, what we are really talking about is a quality of the heart. Is how you're acting towards other people from the inside, how you express that. It can be expressed in different ways. And sometimes if you feel that people are very difficult, they take advantage of you and all of these kind of things, then keep a bit of distance and have compassion from the inside. But if it is difficult, you don't necessarily have to express it always externally. Externally, you can be more neutral. You don't have to be either positive or negative. Be more neutral externally if you feel this too hard to express that compassion. But inside, you can still have understanding towards that person on the towards the other person that you find difficult or whatever. So it is always a balanced thing. And of course, it is very important in our lives that we protect ourselves. We don't leave ourselves open to be hurt and these kind of things. If you allow yourself to be hurt, it's almost like you have some kind of self-hatred. And that's also bad. We have to have kindness towards ourselves, of course, at the same time. So you find this balance in these things. And then I think you are doing things in the right way. I'm not sure if that is exactly what you had in mind. If it's not, then please get back to me later on and ask the question again, and maybe add a little bit more information if that's possible. Okay. Adnan, I'm thinking of writing a living will for my medical care when I am old and sick. I'm a beginner in meditation and have a low threshold for pain. I understand using morphine drugs to reduce pain at the end stage of life may delude our mind. Is it better to die in pain with a clear mind or die in comfort but with a deluded mind for a better rebirth? Thank you. I personally don't think there is a problem with using painkillers when you die. I think it's perfectly okay. It is true that your mind gets a bit deluded when you are on the drugs, but remember, what matters in life is the accumulated karma that you have made during your lifetime. What happens when you die is not so important. And the reason why it is not so important is because when you are released from the body, and this is what happens when you die, the mind releases from the body. As soon as the mind is out of that, the effect of the drugs and the morphine will be gone, because the morphine is a physical thing that works on your brain. As soon as you are released from that brain, you will have clarity again. And that clarity you have at that point will depend on how you have lived your life, and not on what is happening at the moment you die. Right? It is your sila, the morality that you have built up, that is the cause for mindfulness. And that is what is important. I think sometimes if you don't use painkillers and you kind of die in a lot of pain, you may end up dying slightly angry, right? You think, oh, all this pain, what a terrible thing. What, you know, these nurses, they're not really doing their job properly. I shouldn't be having so much pain and that kind of stuff, right? You get upset, and what a terrible thing it is to die and feel angry when you die. You really don't want to do that. So I think it's better to use the painkiller. At least you can be relaxed and at ease. Okay, you're a bit drugged out, right? A bit deluded, a bit like a kind of a drug user, but that's okay. And then you get released from that, and then the clarity comes afterwards. One of the problems with this is that very often in the Theravada teaching, we have this idea of the chuti chitta, which means the mind which kind of is there when we pass away, the last mind moment in the life, and the idea that we re-arise straight away afterwards. But I think it's fairly clear from the suttas that when we pass away, there is a gap from the moment we die until we get reborn properly again in the future life. So for that reason, because there is a gap there, it doesn't matter so much what happens at the moment, at the exact moment you die. What matters is the kind of clarity you have in that gap before you actually move on into a new existence, when karma really takes its effect. So usually that will be a few days, it will take some time. And of course then, because it takes some time, that is where all the old karma comes back to you. You remember everything you have done, and then you get the results of that karma during that process, and then you move on in accordance with that. Yeah? And that is where you judge yourself, right? There's some interesting suttas about that, about the idea of judging ourselves in these kind of things. So, that is my take on that. Yes. Okay. It is difficult to pull family members who are indulged in worldly enjoyment, like watching TV, to listen to Dhamma and read the Dhamma book. Is it because of timing issues, or our influence is not strong enough? It is probably many things, right? One of the things that you have to remember is that everyone has their own habits and their own karma, and there's often only so much you can do for other people. Remember that, you know, sometimes you get a child into your family, and then when you get a child into your family, you want that child to be like this, right? They must be good at school, they must get straight A's all the time at school, they must, all of these kind of things. And we have very high expectations sometimes of our family members, especially our children. But remember, a child comes into your life with its own karma, with its own history coming from the past. And that karma, that history, those habits, that personality will often be far stronger than the conditioning that you can give the child in this life. Right? So there is a limit to how much we can expect of our family members. Our family members have their conditioning their way. So we have to be very gentle with them. One thing that I always remind myself is how hard it is to change my own habits, right? And we all have our habits. Some of them are bad, some of them are good. But it is so hard sometimes to change those bad habits. And the more you realize how hard it is to change your own habits the way you are, then you realize it's exactly the same thing for other people. We shouldn't expect miracles, right? We shouldn't be able to kind of push them, because this is This is the way, they're largely the way they are. So we have to be so gentle and so careful. And the most powerful thing in life is often our example. We have to be the example. We have to live the Dhamma. And when we live the Dhamma, other people will start to be impressed. They will say, whoa, what's going on? My mother is like this. My father is like this. My son, in my case, I'm the son of my parent. Oh, my son is like this. Wow, what's going on? This is amazing. He used to be really rebellious and difficult, and now he's nice, right? But how is that possible? It's like a miracle happening here. And then people get some idea of the power of the Dhamma practice. So very often you have to be gentle. And then take, if you have family members who are more interested in TV, then it's quite a good idea to go and listen to Ajahn Brahm, right? If the TV is entertaining, Ajahn Brahm even more entertaining than the TV here. Right? So tell them, okay, I've got this really good teacher for you. Actually, he doesn't teach much Dhamma, forget, but he tells really good jokes. So please come along and enjoy yourself a little bit. And this is kind of the idea with a good teacher. He's able to draw people into the Dhamma. There's that famous old saying, I think it's a Tibetan saying, or some Tibetan monk who apparently said this, is that the way to teach the Dhamma is that you tell some good stories, right? Until people are gaping away, laughing, the mouth wide open. And when the mouth is wide open with laughter, you throw in the pill of wisdom at that point. And there's some truth to that, right? Because when you're having a good time, and when you're relaxing, and when you're enjoying yourself, you relax. You sit back, you're having a good time, and when you relax, that is when kind of this teaching come in. If you're too tired and too tense and not really enjoying yourself, it's very hard to take these teachings in properly. So there's all kind of skillful means that sometimes you use. So use these little skillful means. Just do things in the right way, and watch yourself, watch what works right with the people around you, and then gradually, there's likely that you will be able to have some influence on the people around you if you do things in the right way. And that is great. But the most powerful thing, I think, is usually the power of example. And show that it works for you, then other people will have a natural interest. Okay. If the arising of a Buddha is due to random coming together of all supportive causes, how are we going to be hopeful of our ultimate success in spiritual effort on the path? Thank you, Ajahn. Well, it is random for the Buddha, right? Because it's not really random, because cause and conditions, they come together in a certain way. But it's more like it's not really a systematic practice of the path as it is once you have the Buddha arising in the world. There are cause and conditions coming together. You can't really tell when they're going to come together because it is so complicated. That's why it looks like it is random. But of course, nothing in the world is really random as such. It all depends on things influencing each other. But it is still, it looks as if it's random from the outside. And that's why it happens only very rarely that all of these cause and conditions actually arise. But once a Buddha has arisen, once we have a teacher, it is no longer random. Right? That is why at this point, when the teachings are there, that is why it is so good to allow ourselves to be brainwashed. Because now we have the right washing powder. The Buddha... The Buddha didn't have the right washing powder, right? That was his problem. He didn't have the, I don't know what it's supposed to be, but he didn't have that. He didn't have the Noble Eightfold Path. Now it is available. So now you allow yourself to be influenced by that, conditioned by that. And then these things happen as a matter of course. For us, it is no longer random. It was only really random for the Buddha, if you like. Yeah. And this is the beautiful thing about having a teaching. And that is why I am very skeptical of the Bodhisattva path. It is not only in Mahayana Buddhism, also in Theravada we have the Bodhisattva path. I know quite a few monks who claim to be Bodhisattvas and practice in that path. But that is why I'm so skeptical of that, because there isn't really any path. There is no system to get you there. The only system there is the Noble Eightfold Path, and that is what takes you to awakening. And that's why it is so important to use that opportunity now that it is available. Because now we have these teachings here. Now is a chance to actually get there in that practice. So you have every reason to be really hopeful, right? Because the teachings are there. And the ultimate success only depends on your commitment and perseverance in the practice. And if you commit and persevere, then you will make progress and perhaps even have really good success in your spiritual life. Okay. Dear Ajahn, what is the difference between Buddha and Arahant? Can Arahant become Buddha if his practice is further? Okay, so what is the difference? The difference, according to the suttas, is that the Buddha got there first, whereas the Arahants, they are the disciples who practice afterwards. That is the only difference, according to the suttas, right? So sometimes people say, what? You must be kidding. It can't be the only difference. It must be more than that. Surely Buddha is something special. But actually, that is quite special because the very idea that you are able to reach full awakening without a teacher, somehow finding your way through this, it takes very special qualities. Right? The vast majority of us, we are all disciples. We're trying to follow the same path. Difficult enough already, right? Already hard enough. How many of you are arahants, right? Not so many, right? So not so many arahants here. So because of not so many arahants, it means that it's hard enough already. So imagine if you have no teacher. If you have no teacher, it is far, far more difficult. And that is what is so impressive about the Buddha, what is so exceptional about him, that you're able to break through without actually having anybody to teach you beforehand. So this is the difference. Can the Arahant become a Buddha if he practices further? Well, remember, the Arahant, this is last life of the Arahant, right? So there's only a few years left, and then they die. And they are already Arahants in this life, so there isn't anything further to be done. You can't really become a Buddha, because a Buddha, by definition, is somebody who arises when there is no other Buddhism around, when there is no other Buddha around, there is no Dhamma around. Because that is what, by definition, is a Buddha. It's too late. If you become an Arahant, it's impossible to become a Buddha, right? But forget about the whole Buddha thing. The point is to reach awakening. The point is to understand reality. Whether you do that as an Arahant or a Buddha is kind of irrelevant. Take the easy way. Easy way is Arahant way. If you take the Buddha way, there is no way at all for that. So it's completely... it's a lost cause, really. So I would never recommend anyone to try the Buddha path, because it's just not going to happen. That's basically, I think, the reality here. Okay, so Dear Ajahn, sometimes the more I meditate or retreat, reflect on Dhamma, the more stressful I become. Okay, wow, that's okay. Now I've gotten to the point where I don't feel confident that I'll ever experience deep meditation again. Please explain to me why this has happened and how could I change my attitude towards meditation? Thank you. Okay, well, I hope you don't feel stressed while you're here. I hope you're enjoying the little time we have together here, that you don't feel too bad about that. You don't feel confident that you will ever experience deep meditation again. Well, you should be really happy that at least you have had some experience of deep meditation. That's already a wonderful thing. It means that you have some kind of insight into the Dhamma, some kind of understanding of something more profound. And this is often the sort of thing that actually drives us forward on the path if we are wise about it. Most people have never had any really deep meditation, maybe a little bit, but not too much. And the fact that you have had something of that means that you already have something incredibly valuable and beautiful in your life. You will remember this, and this will kind of help you forward. That's why you're asking this question now. That's why you're kind of heading in the right way. I like the way Ajahn Brahm talks about the jhana, deep samadhi experience. He calls it a positive trauma. Right? usually trauma means, oh, really bad. It's something that you remember in life. You had a really bad experience, and it kind of comes back and haunts you all the time. You dream about it. You think about it. You can't let go of it because it's a terrible experience. Positive trauma is the opposite. It is so blissful. You can't get it out of your mind. For the rest of your life, you're stuck with this incredibly blissful memory in your mind, right? And this is part of the problem with having some experience of deep meditation. Once it is there, it is very easy to crave for these things. And that craving and desire for those things is part of the problem which blocks you from re-attaining these things. So it is so important on the Buddhist path that we focus on the causes, right? The conditions, those things that actually give rise to these things, instead of focusing on the thing itself. If you think of the thing, if you think of the experience you want to get, craving, desire arises. If you instead think of, what do I need to do now to actually to move forward on the path, then you will be heading in the right direction. And one of those things that we need to do is just to enjoy everything you do in meditation practice. Whatever it is that you have, enjoy that. So you sit back, right? You breathe easily and the body starts to become a little bit more comfortable because you are relaxing. That is already a small benefit of meditation practice. Your mind becomes a little bit more peaceful. Suddenly you find yourself, wow, how nice it is to be here at the BGF Center, right, with so many other wonderful people around me who practice really well, who are so kind. What a wonderful thing it is to be in the presence of the Dhamma, to hear the suttas of the Buddha. Basically, there's so many good things happening to me. And then you feel a sense of contentment and ease, and you increase the mindfulness and the ability to stay in the present moment. So little things like that, be happy with whatever you have already. And when you do that, contentment starts to set in, that you're doing the right thing, you're living well now, things are not so bad. Get that idea out of your head that you want to be what you had in the past, because that is only going to hinder you. Go to the causes, right? Causes, 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 conditions, conditions, conditions is really the issue here. One of the very important things that I've been talking about a lot already, about what makes meditation work, is the purity of our heart, is the degree of kindness that we have, right? It's all about sila, it's all about our mind state, it's all about our ability to be kind and compassionate and understanding in the world. So look at your sila. Is there something you can do better in terms of these things? Can you be more kind and compassionate? Can you be a more caring person? Can you avoid a little bit of that ill will that arises every now and again? And the more you can move in that direction, the more peaceful and the more pleasant your mind state will be in meditation practice itself. Sila is the foundation for everything else, right? So that is really where you have to put in the most effort. And if you're able to have a good heart almost at all times, then when the meditation comes, you will have that uplift. That goodness will already be there. And because the goodness is there, it is actually quite easy to meditate as a consequence. You just feel naturally good, right? When you feel naturally good, things are quite easy. And this is kind of part of this idea of sila nusati, recollection of sila that we have on the Buddhist path. And if you do that, then those deep meditation experiences, they will come again. But they won't come again when you want them to come. And this is such an important thing. It's only when you forget them completely that they will tend to return. As long as you want them to return, that very wanting will stop the returning of those states. Yeah, so just forget about all that and kind of move on instead with the causes and the conditions. So this is how to change your attitude and probably maybe why this is happening here. So just keep on. Never, the fact that you've had a taste of this is already wonderful. You should be so happy about that. This is pretty much what happened to me as well. Before I became a monk, I had some nice experience in meditation. And that is one of the main reasons why I became a monk. Other things as well, but that was one of the main things that really propelled me forward on the Buddhist path. So these things are actually very valuable. Even if it takes time and dedication, now you are investigating what's going on. You have that's already the right attitude. The fact that you are investigating and trying to find out what the problem is. Okay, good luck. So, Is there any sutta that tells of the Buddha teaching the mentally ill people so they can be able to gain a better rebirth? Good question. Does it teach the mentally ill people anywhere? Not sure. I guess we're all mentally ill to some extent. That's what the Buddha says, right? We're all kind of angry people. If you get angry, that means you're mentally ill, according to the Buddhist teachings. So I think he doesn't really say too much about that. I think very often, if you are mentally ill, sometimes you just have to wait till that mental illness kind of stops, and then you can kind of start practice again. It's very hard to practice. It depends what kind of mental illness it is, right? There are different types of mental illness. And it's very different today than it was in those days, because in those days they didn't have any medication that could support you. For example, if you have things like schizophrenia, these days that can be treated quite well with drugs. And because it can be treated with drugs, you can still have a Buddhist practice, even if you have something as disturbing as schizophrenia. When you have all this involuntary thinking that seems to come from the outside, can be very, very disturbing, right? Well, then drugs are great. They get rid of those thoughts, and then you can practice and live a more normal life. We shouldn't be too afraid of drugs in this world. This is one of the great things about living in the modern world, that we have access to medication that can help these kind of things. Also, if you are someone is severely depressed, then I think also it is not a bad idea to use some drugs to get rid of some of that. It's much better to do that than to end up committing suicide or something like that. That is not really going to be very helpful at all. So use those drugs. And once you kind of get a balance in your mind, then it is quite possible again to start practicing the teachings of the Buddha, just like everybody else does. That is what I would recommend, and then hopefully they will gradually move out of that mental illness and become better. And maybe, who knows, one day they might be able to come off those drugs, especially things like depression. These things tend to turn around quite, not fast maybe, but over time they turn around, especially if you're practicing well and doing things in the right way. With schizophrenia, it's a bit more difficult. That too can apparently end sometimes, but a lot of the time it is something that lasts, at least for this life. And then when you get rid of that old brain, right, chuck out the old brain, get a new one maybe in the next life, then you will be back in business again. Because you often, it's just a chemical thing in the brain which is problematic there. Okay. If habitual mental and bodily activities play a great part in future rebirth, what happens to the various mentally ill and brain damaged people, especially the moderately ill and severely ill? Thank you, Venerable Ajahn. Okay, so again, a lot of the mental illness and brain damage is just part of the physical aspect of the brain. It does not necessarily have anything to do with the mind as such. So as soon as you get rid of that old brain and you kind of move on, right, often you are okay again afterwards. One of the interesting things, it was a book I was reading a few years ago called Irreducible Mind was the name of the book, and it was all about this research. It was researching about mind and what the mind is and how it compares with the physical brain and all this kind of stuff. And one of the nice little stories in there was the stories of people at hospitals who had been observing people who have severe dementia, like Alzheimer and that kind of diseases. And what they were saying is that in many, many hospitals, this is an experience that many doctors and nurses have had around the world, is that towards the very end of the life of somebody who has Alzheimer or dementia, suddenly, towards the very end, they become clear. Right? Suddenly, in the last moments before they die, son, daughter, right? Mother, father, maybe mother, father, because if you're Alzheimer's, you probably don't have that anymore, but son, daughter, wife, husband, right, friend, whatever it is. How wonderful. Thank you for coming and visiting me. Bang, dead, right? And it's very interesting because from the ordinary point of view, of medical point of view, of Western kind of standard medical science these days, it is almost inexplicable. Because if you are the brain and you are nothing apart from the brain, there's absolutely no reason why you should be able to wake up towards the very end. And suddenly, you haven't remembered people for 20 years, and suddenly you remember everybody again. But from a Buddhist point of view, it makes extremely good sense. Because from a Buddhist point of view, towards the very end of your life, that is when your mind is starting to separate from the body. The diseased brain no longer has control over your mind. Your mind is moving out of that. So towards the very end, you are actually able then to recognize people again. And this shows you that really what the brain is more like a filter that filters the mind. The mind is there, and the brain blocks, the sick brain blocks the mind from functioning in an ordinary way. And that's why people with Alzheimer's seem so terribly bad. As soon as they are released from that, they are okay, right? And exactly the same thing with many other types of mental illness that comes from brain damage, comes from chemical imbalances in the brain. When you die, you are released from that. You are okay again. So, ideally, what we should do is always try to live in such a way, live well, do the right things, do the right karma. Then, when we are released from that, again, our mindfulness returns. And then we will kind of get the benefit of all those good actions afterwards. So that is why I think it is important to use medication as well. Because by using medication, then you balance things out. Then you can start to live life well and be a good Buddhist and actually make good karma. And by making good karma, then you will ensure that you have a good rebirth as a consequence. That is why it is actually very useful to use medication. If you don't use medication, you're completely out of it because you are just completely deluded or whatever. You can't even make any good karma anymore. Okay. In meditation, I feel vibration at the front part of the head. Thereon, I watch the breath at that spot, hear the sound at that spot, not through the sense door. Why is that so? I don't know why it's so. One of the things about meditation is that all kinds of perceptions and things often arise in meditation practice. You close your eyes and remember the mind is the most creative thing of all. The mind creates pretty much everything here. Right? So when we think about rebirth, any kind of rebirth is really mind created. The mind is what creates everything. So once you close your eyes, you start to feel the world in a slightly different way. And the mind will kind of create its own perception of things, kind of space will be slightly changed, the perception of the body will be slightly changed. Sometimes it feels when you become very light and everything is very easy, it may feel like you're floating, it may feel like your body is expanding. There's a famous story of Ajahn Chah, he had some meditation experience where he felt like his body exploded and all his intestines were hanging over the branches of trees. Right? That's quite an strange experience, isn't it? All the intestines explode out, and your heart is over there, your liver is over here, right? And your all intestines everywhere. Very strange thing. So these are mind-made creations. And what you're having here is a very slight mind-made creation. What you're feeling is just a vibration at the top of your head. So I wouldn't worry about that. If you feel peaceful, if you feel at ease, if you feel not confused and deluded, and you feel that everything is roughly right, there is nothing to worry about. The only worry in meditation is that if you feel mentally not stable and at ease, that is when meditation can be a bit dodgy. If you feel that you become confused, you become angry, deluded or whatever, that is when meditation is heading down the wrong track. If the mind is clear and bright, then if you have strange experiences, it doesn't matter, as long as the mind is in the right spot. So we should never really force meditation too much. Sometimes people force meditation too much and they have some terrible experiences because of that. It should be easy, natural, enjoyable. If it isn't enjoyable, you need to change what you're doing, try to find a different way. Sometimes people are not even ready for meditation at all, and that's okay, you know. You don't have to meditate. It is enough to live a good life as a Buddhist. That is the far more important thing. If you can't meditate, please don't feel bad about that, especially if you find that you have bad experiences. Better not to meditate at all and just live your life well to the best of your ability. Meditation is not the kind of the end-all and be-all of the Buddhist path. Far from it. The goodness of the heart is far, far more important on this path. Okay. Dear Ajahns, are ghosts in the hell realm? Are ghosts the result of being trapped in between rebirth? Thank you. According to the usual Buddhist ideas, there are usually talking about three lower realms, right? The ghost realm, the animal realm, and the hell realm. This is kind of the standard thing that you see in the suttas. So the ghosts are not really in the hell realm. The hell realm is supposed to be even worse. So ghosts are happy compared to the hell realm beings. So being a ghost is not too bad, right? Being a ghost is kind of the first level down. And then animals are actually below that. And then hell realm below that again. So are ghosts the result of being trapped between rebirth? It can be, right? After you die, you may hang out in the ghost realm for a while before you move on. Or you can actually stay in the ghost realm as well. You can actually take rebirth there. It is both, can both be an intermediate state, and it can also be a place of rebirth. But one of the nice things about the ghost realm is that it is possible when you are there to actually receive the benefit of other people's kind acts towards you. This is the good thing about the ghost realm. And we all probably have relatives in the ghost realm, right? Our ghost realm is so vast and we have so many past lives. Almost guaranteed that we have some relatives in the ghost realm. So by sharing the merit with all your relatives, your parents and everyone else, it is very likely somebody there will be able to receive that merit. So it's a very nice thing to do. Say, oh, you know, whatever relative from the past, I do this in your name. Or you can do it in the name of your parents. And if your parents can't receive it, or your grandparents, or whatever it is, then some other relative from a long time in the past will be able to receive that. So that is the good thing about that. Okay, good. So I hope that helps. Bhante, we learn not to cling to the body and that the body is not the self. Why do Buddhists revere and worship relics of past arahants? Why so much significance on relics, sadhu? isn't there going to be a relic exhibition here? Yeah. I have to be careful what I say, right? I might become very unpopular with Dr. Wee if I say the wrong thing. So I think that it is important to remember how perhaps we use these things. We have to use them with a little bit of care. I tend to agree. I must admit I don't have much interest in relics myself, to be perfectly honest. The Buddha said that relics, you know, why worship this body? It is actually the practice that really matters. But people are different, and sometimes people get maybe a bit inspired by seeing the relics. Maybe they think, oh, now we have kind of a more direct connection with the Buddha and these past arahants or whatever. So maybe people feel a bit inspired by that. And I don't want to destroy people's inspiration. That's a terrible thing to do. So if people do get inspired by that, I think that is okay. And there is a bit of difference here, of course, between the monastic Sangha and the lay people. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, Venerable Ananda asked the Buddha, what shall we do with the body after we cremated you? And the Buddha says, leave that to the lay people. Right? That's what he says. And the idea is that as monastics, well, it is more important for the monastics to get on with the practice, and then the lay people would look after the body. So it is okay. If you find it inspiring, that is fine. If you don't feel that it is inspiring, that is fine as well. You don't have to feel guilty that if you're watching the relics, you don't feel inspired by that. It's perfectly okay not to feel inspired as well. Right? Either way is fine. So, how much significance on relics? I would say small significance. The significance should be on the practice, keeping the five precepts, right? A lot of the time you find Buddhists, they come to watch the relics. Wow, these relics. Don't keep any precepts, don't do anything else except watching the relics. That is getting things the wrong way around, right? If you're going to choose keeping the five precepts. Far, far more important than seeing relics. So find this nice balance. And when you find this nice balance, then you are on the right track. Don't be too judgmental. If other people find it inspiring, don't be judgmental of people, because we are all different. We all have different mindsets. We all think about things in a different way. And there is not one right way of doing these things. There are many ways of doing this. Okay, Bhante, is it correct to say that the rebirth process involves the transfer of consciousness from one life to another? Can you share how craving results in rebirth, and is one's destination of next rebirth determined entirely by one's karma? Okay, so is it correct to say the rebirth involves a transfer of consciousness from one life to another? And in a sense, that is true. The way that the Buddha talks about this, he talks about the stream of consciousness being established in one life and then being established in another life, right? So it is a stream of consciousness moving along. But that stream of consciousness is not a self-same, identical consciousness that goes from one life to another one. It is a stream, just like a river. When you watch the river, you see the water flowing past. It looks, the shape of the river is roughly the same, right? The habits we have, the way we deal with the world are roughly the same. Just like the shape of the river is roughly the same. But the actual water changes every second. Every second there's new molecules, new water in that river. In the same way, the consciousness is always moving along. It's never the same consciousness. It is new bits of consciousness arising and passing away all along. But it looks roughly the same because of the habits and the way we tend to live our life. So that is really, I think, the best way to do it. And you can think about it. You can think about it also in this present life. The present life, it is just same really as the rebirth process. In the present life, your mind is always changing a little bit, but there are also habits that persist, right? Every moment it feels like things are changing. It feels like your perception is slightly different. Now you're looking there, now looking over here. And of course the mind is influenced by that. So always slight differences, but also continuation in terms of habits. How does craving result in rebirth? And is one's destination in next birth determined entirely by one's karma or karma? Well, the way that craving is this force that projects you into the future. Craving is always about the future, right? When you crave for something, it's about a place you want to be where you are not now. That is the very nature of craving. Most of that craving is craving for sensual things, things that you already have, things you want to hold on to, but also new things that you haven't got yet. And it's about some kind of future thing, the way you want things to be in the future. You don't want to lose your possessions. That's about the future. You want to get new things. That's about the future. Right? All about the future. Craving for existence is the same thing. You already exist, so you don't crave for that. What you do is you're craving for continued existence. You want to continue existing in your future life as well. It's about projecting yourself into the future. You want to be there at that point as well. So this is really what's happening. Craving is kind of creating this continuous future. And it's happening in this life, and it's also happening from one life to the next one. Now, one of the things that you see, this is what, in a sense, what stream entry is about, right? I remember asking, talking with Ajahn Brahm about this, and we were discussing about the whole idea of how craving creates a future existence. And what happens is that when you see, when you become a stream entry, what you do is that you see the Dhamma for the first time. Seeing the Dhamma means that you see suffering completely. Right? You see non-self and you see suffering completely. Seeing suffering completely means understanding that the five khandhas, in other words, your entire experience, everything you experience is suffering in one way or another. That is what you see for the first time. When you see that, you cannot crave for anything anymore. If everything is suffering that you experience, how can you crave for anything? You cannot crave for any so-called sensual pleasures because you realize it's all empty. You cannot crave for existence because existence is precisely the five khandhas. Now you see that the five khandhas are suffering. You can't crave for that anymore. For the first time in your life, you have no craving for anything, no attachment to anything. And what you see when that happens is that you see that that force, and this is what craving is, the force that drives you forward is gone for the very, very first time. There is no underlying tendency. There's no attachment. There's nothing there anymore which actually drives you forward. And at that point, when you see that that force is gone, you understand the connection between that force and the continuation of consciousness in the future. You can see that that force is what drives consciousness forward, because now that the force is gone, you know that consciousness must come to an end. Existence must come to an end. Right? That is what you, that is kind of the idea of stream entry, seeing that connection between craving and, when craving is gone, the ending of the whole process itself. It is not something that is really, I think, possible to explain, because these things are, in the end, they have to be realized, but you can have some idea of what is happening there. So that's when we talk about seeing the Four Noble Truths. Seeing the Third Noble Truth is seeing precisely how the ending of craving must lead to the ending of all existence sometime in the future. Okay. Dear Ajahn, how would the special children, those children born with brain defects like Down syndrome, autistics, mongoloids, that's Down syndrome, mentally, etc., impaired, be able to gain better rebirth? I think that it depends, right? It really depends on how we treat them. I think a lot of the time, if we treat them well so that they live happy lives, then they will also do better actions. And for that reason, they will probably do a little bit of good karma. Although, if you have a lot of brain defects, the amount of karma that you make is probably much less, because you have less clarity about what you're doing. You don't really know what is going on so much. So the worse the brain damage is, the less karma you're probably making. It's a bit like an animal. An animal often doesn't make much karma because it doesn't really know what it's doing. It's kind of following the instincts and doing things according to genetics and that kind of stuff, rather than actually doing things because they really want to do things that way. So, but I think by treating these people who have difficulties well, by being kind to them, being supportive, we're giving them a chance to feel better about themselves, and then they will also express that through their own actions. So very important, I think, to treat people well, even though they have these kind of problems. Autistic, there are many different degrees of autism, and some are very mild, and they are almost fully functioning like ordinary people. It's not really a major problem. Most of us have a little bit of these things already, right? It's true, isn't it? It's all in there, waiting to kind of come out. So so we should be careful not to be too judgmental about other people, because it's there. But I think in the end, what will often happen is that they go through this life with that brain defect, probably don't make too much good karma or bad karma, and then hopefully in the next life they will be reborn and they will be kind of more normal again, and then they will kind of carry on from there. That I think is probably the most likely scenario in that case. Okay, dear Ajahn, can you please elaborate on the birth of the Buddha? A lot of texts I read said or mentioned his birth is from a lotus. Is that his first, and that his first step are on the lotus leaf? Thank you. Okay, so if you want to read about the birth of the Buddha, there is a sutta called the Marvelous and Wonderful Majjhima Nikaya 123, which talks about, if you like, the birth of the Buddha. 1-2-3, Majjhima Nikaya 1-2-3. Acharya Abhuta Sutta in the Pali language. Now, that text has a lot of things that are kind of marvelous and amazing. That's why it's called the Marvelous and Amazing Sutta. And sometimes with these kind of suttas, you have to be a little bit careful, a little bit skeptical about how kind of trustworthy it all is. That particular sutta is spoken by Ananda, first of all, not by the Buddha. And that kind of gives you straight away, you wonder whether it is absolutely true because of that. And what is kind of strange about it is that the Buddha, Venerable Ananda says, oh, I have heard this from the Buddha himself. So if Ananda has heard it from the Buddha himself, why don't we hear that sutta that the Buddha spoke himself? Right? Most of the time, Venerable Ananda has heard the suttas and he repeats, the Buddha said this and this, and then you hear what the Buddha said. But in this case, Venerable Ananda said, well, the Buddha said this, and then he keeps on talking instead of actually kind of giving it over to the Buddha. So I'm not entirely sure about that. That's one thing. The other thing about this sutta, which is slightly not so also quite interesting, is that if you compare the version which is translated into Chinese Agamas, and you compare that with the Pali, there is a lot of differences between the suttas. One sutta has many extra miraculous and wonderful and marvelous events, and the other one has many other ones that the other one doesn't have. There's only a few in common, right? And when these things happen, you get this feeling that the sutta has been kind of expanded upon. More marvelous and miraculous things have been added over time. And people probably do it for a good reason, out of faith and all of these kind of things. But you get the feeling it is not so as authentic as many of the other teachings. So some of the things in there may very well be right. Some of the other things I would take with a big pinch of salt, to be honest with you, and I wouldn't take it too seriously. The idea that he's born from a lotus, well, that must be, I don't know where that is from. It's not from that sutta. Even the first step on the lotus leaves, I don't think it is there either. That's probably even more unreliable, right? This is probably very unreliable things. Anyway, remember the Buddha was a human being, right? He had a mother, just like everyone else. So that's what happened. That's the way it goes when you are a human being. Okay, so here we go. Is it useful to contemplate on death during meditation? E.g., if I died now, can I let go? Am I ready? Indeed, I think that is a very useful contemplation, to contemplate on death. If you do it in the right way, that is exactly what happens. You start to let go because you realize you can't really hold on to anything in this world. I'm going to talk more about death contemplation later on, so stay tuned, and then you will get the get that practice later on. How many of you are going to leave after the first 4 days? How many of you are going to leave after? Okay, ooh, quite a few. Okay, whoa. Okay, it will be recorded. So maybe you can watch the recordings later on. Is that right, Bobby? Yeah. Okay, so you get the recordings later on. But it is a very nice kind of meditation. Does practicing meditation help towards getting ready for the moment of death? Sure, of course it does. It is very powerful for that kind of thing, because if you are used to calming your mind, used to kind of being peaceful, then when death comes, you can do the same thing on your deathbed. Feel peaceful, feel relaxed. In fact, your deathbed is often a very powerful time to feel that peace, because the deathbed, you know that you have to let go. You have no choice, right? Okay, I'm going to die, okay? So you're almost forced to let go, and that encourages you to let go at that time. So the more practice you have in meditation at that time, it will help you to move in the right direction. And then maybe you can even attain some deep state, right, of samadhi or whatever, on your deathbed. Wouldn't that be nice? Right? Whoa, wow, so deep and nice. This is kind of one of the beautiful things about knowing a little bit about meditation practice. Okay. What are the few things that the Buddha does not talk about or answer, e.g. no first beginning, no creator God, no place where the Buddha goes after Mahaparinibbana? Yes, there are the 10 topics that he does not give an answer to, right? And these 10 topics is the world eternal or not eternal? Is the soul the same as the body or not the same as the body? Does the Tathagata exist after death or not? These kind of questions. And the reason why he doesn't answer those questions is because the question is wrong. The question is misguided. It's a bit like asking somebody, how often do you beat your wife? I don't beat my wife, so how can you ask that question, right? You're assuming that somebody's beating the wife, but actually they're not beating the wife, so it is the wrong question to ask. And these questions are the same. They're kind of assuming that there is a soul there, right? Is the soul the same as the body? Or is it different from the body? Well, if there is no soul, it's impossible to answer that question, because the question is wrong in the first place. And this is why the Buddha doesn't answer these things, because the question is wrongly put in the first place. Yeah? Okay. I'm going fast now so that we will finish on time, so that we don't stress it out too much. Bhante, question, how do I practice correct, right metta? Karuna, I frequently feel my compassion and metta is tainted by too much thinking, and my intention is to help. E.g., my intention is to help the beggar in the street, but often further thought, but after further thought, I withhold the money. Okay. Yes, sometimes the thinking mind is a bit tricky, isn't it? That beggar, they're kind of just going to misuse the money I give them and all these kind of things. But it really depends. I mean, we can never be sure that our donations, whatever we do, go to the right place. It's impossible to be absolutely sure of that. But what you can be sure, if you are generous, generally speaking, you are doing something good in the world. Most of the times, it will go to a good place. Most of the times, the beggar will use the money in the right way. Sometimes not. But that's okay, right? People are deluded. People are doing the wrong thing. It's not really such a big deal. You still give, and you still kind of, at the very least, maybe that beggar will kind of feel happy that somebody is kind, right? Even if they use that money in the wrong way. Maybe they will be inspired by your kindness, inspired by your actions. So always don't allow that cynical mind, right, to get in the way and stop you from doing kindness. If you do that, then you're blocking yourself from making so much good karma in this world. So be very careful with that. Just know that in general, your kindness and goodness will go in the right direction. That is really what you need to do here. Yes, and it is interesting. Often when I think about my life and I think back on the people who have been kind to me in my life, I often just feel inspired by the example of kindness. I feel inspired when people have done something kind of out of the goodness of their heart. And I remember, whether it's my parents or whoever it is, often when you are a recipient of kindness, you feel, wow, that is so inspiring. And it's such a beautiful thing. And it lifts you up. And often it has this kind of, it kind of spreads out into society. You're kind to one person. They feel inspired. They are kind to somebody else again. It has this ripple effect spreading out to so many people. So don't underestimate your kindness. Don't underestimate your generosity. Often it has tremendously powerful effects on the people around you. So you become the cause for kind of spreading out of kindness in society, right? And we need that kindness in society. There's so much conflict and so many problems in the world. If everyone is a little bit more kind, wow, even if just within the Buddhist community, it's going to help lift everyone else up and make everyone else feel better, everyone else be more happy in the world. So don't underestimate these things. They're often very powerful. Be careful of that cynical mind. Know that on average you're doing a lot of good through kindness and generosity. Okay, last question for this evening. In Pra Ajahn Plien's book, A Practicing Guide to Peace, he advocates that we should find a suitable place to sit, and we should face the three directions, south, west, and east, but we are to avoid the north. Okay? Why should we avoid the north direction? Is this a Thai culture, or is this stated in the Buddha's teachings? I don't know why it is we should avoid the north. I think this must be some kind of tradition that has been handed down somewhere. It's not found in the suttas, doesn't say in the suttas anywhere. So this must be some other kind of tradition. I don't know why that is the case. I must admit, I don't really think it matters which way you are sitting, because sometimes you don't even know, right, where the north is. Like me now, I have no idea where the north is, and I'm kind of, you know, KL, this is foreign territory to me, so I don't know what's going on. So I don't think, maybe I'm facing north, maybe that's why my meditation is going so bad. I'm just joking around. I think it's probably more like just a habit or a way of thinking than really, I don't know how important that particular piece of advice actually is in practice. I don't think probably it matters all that much. Certainly not said by the Buddha. Okay, so there you are. That is all the fun and games for this evening. So have a nice night, sleep well, and then we'll see you again tomorrow morning. And then in the meantime, let's just pay respect to the Triple Gem. Thank you.